When we talk about the economy, often we're talking about change. Change in the way we work, the way we buy things, the rules and policies that govern our financial lives. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And then there's adapting to change, figuring out, okay, Congress voted a certain way, what does that mean for me? Or a big employer in my town shut down, well, how can the city change to keep jobs? Can a person change so a robot doesn't take their job? None of this is easy, and some of it is downright wrenching. Occasionally, it can be fun. After all, Americans love to talk about innovation and disruption, and pretty much every technology pitch involves the phrase changing the world. We know it has been a dramatic week in foreign policy, but for this hour, we're going to focus largely on the domestic economy. We go to a city that's trying to change what it does without losing its essential character, meet entrepreneurs who are building new businesses, and even a robot who might one day change how you get things delivered to your house. As always, come talk to me or the team. We're at marketplace.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter. No changes to our handle. It's still at @marketplace_WKND. Over the past few months, we've brought you stories from a couple of small cities around the country. Dalton, Georgia, and Gillette, Wyoming. You're probably familiar with them. We've had their mayors on the show pretty regularly, along with the mayor of Corvallis, Oregon. And that's where we went on our latest reporting trip, the final one in this series. Corvallis is a college town. Oregon State University is there. The area votes Democratic. Indeed, it's a sanctuary city with a sanctuary campus. The issues Corvallis wrestles with are really about town, gown, and growth. They're good problems to have, mainly how to use some of that gown brain power to create a startup hub without damaging the city's culture. I'm going to be totally honest here. There are reporting assignments that involve harsh conditions, adversarial interviews, even some physical danger. This was not one of those.
That one will perk you up a little bit.
That's Nick Arzner offering me a ridiculously Oregon-sounding beer, a Cosmic Cold Brew. It's a stout, cold-brewed, locally roasted coffee.
Wow. I did not think that this would be for me, but this is really good. It's very, like, velvety.
Yeah. Good at 5 a.m. and 5 p.m.
Arzner and his wife, Kristen, started Block 15 Brewing Company here in Corvallis in 2008. We went to visit the newest of their three locations on the south side of the Willamette River. There's a beautiful view of trees and mountains from the restaurant up front, and there are huge tanks for brewing beer in the back.
To one side over here, we have our grain room. That's where we store our grain. Right on the outside of the wall is the big silo you saw when you drove in.
Because of Oregon State and its 25,000 undergrads, there's a real mix here in Corvallis. Students, faculty, visitors, and residents who live here because it's a beautiful small city. Arzner's built a thriving but small business catering to them.
I don't know, there's just something to be said for having your finger on things and being a part of things. And we're much larger than I ever thought we would be, but we're not larger than we need to be.
Larger than we need to be. There's a strong movement in town for businesses to grow, to capitalize on ideas from the university and community and turn them into profitable companies. And so, over more coffee, we met up with someone trying to make that happen.
I'm Caroline Cummings, and I'm a venture catalyst for RAIN, the Regional Accelerator and Innovation Network.
What does venture catalyst mean?
I work with entrepreneurs and innovators who have big ideas, and they want to launch either nationally or internationally.
Think of Cummings as a matchmaker. She and her network, RAIN, yes, like the weather, work with Oregon State's Advantage Accelerator to help launch companies here. One's making everything from food and beverages to a new kind of suture for emergency rooms.
Over the last 2 years since we've been tracking the economic impact of RAIN, there's been about 50 companies who have gone through the accelerator programs. Those 50 companies have generated around $5 million in revenue, and they've raised around $10 million in capital. And that's created about 105 jobs.
Their big success story is Agility Robotics.
This is our second robot.
We met a robot. Her name is Cassie. Jonathan Hurst, the Oregon State professor who helped create her, introduced us.
Imagine an ostrich but with a much, much smaller body to go with the big ostrich legs and no neck or head.
Cassie is named for the bird cassowary, and she, or it, I mean, it's a robot, is the main product of Agility Robotics. And Cassie can walk like a giant bird. That's her moving across the floor. Hurst and two other co-founders created Agility Robotics after he went through the OSU Accelerator. The money wasn't hard to come by. Lots of venture capitalists want to fund robot companies. He needed something else.
We're not looking for just dollars. We're looking for help and partnerships. You know, I've been a professor, but I have never started a company before.
Oregon State has a stake in the company. Agility's technology is licensed from the university. And all you need to do is watch Cassie walk to know that her mobility will be wildly valuable. Imagine a future where a driverless FedEx or UPS van pulls up to your house with a package.
There's an array of solutions for how do you get the packages and things from those delivery vans to the doorstep. And you see the drones, some wheeled vehicles, but none of those are going to handle stairs and crowded urban environments, and legs certainly can.
Cassie can step over a flower pot, avoid the family dog. And Hurst says there's more we can't even contemplate yet.
It's like imagining what smartphones will do for us, you know, back when they imagined them for the original Star Trek.
So, okay, why keep this company in Oregon? It seems like a natural fit for Silicon Valley. And that's when Jonathan Hurst looks at me like I'm crazy.
It's not a competitive environment. It's not where, you know, one person's success detracts from another's. It's that a rising tide lifts all boats. I really, really appreciate that culture here.
And they got that. Their company is right by the river in Albany, Oregon, 10 miles from Corvallis. They moved over here because there's more space and it's cheaper. The mayor of Corvallis, Biff Traber, would love for Agility to be based in his city limits. He's an evangelist for growth, but wants to avoid the kind of problems that startups brought to Silicon Valley. Gentrification, rising prices that make it tough for the middle class to live there. We took a drive with him out of Corvallis's cute downtown, past lush green lawns and trees draped with moss.
So now I'm heading out along the river, but I was going to take you out by the HP campus.
That's Hewlett-Packard. In the 90s, it employed about 10,000 people in town. Now, fewer than 2,000 people work there, but the company leases out this building space.
It now has a large number of our startup businesses and long-term businesses.
Traber, who's a former software executive, wants new startups to move in there. Still, he needs to balance growth with Corvallis's coffee shop, microbrewery, college town vibe.
There's a group of people in town who would like Corvallis to stay the way it is or the way it was 20 or 40 years ago.
But Oregon State has added 10,000 more students in the past two decades. That's led to a housing crunch. Developers and the college are rushing to build more apartments and multifamily homes. If Traber can help make that happen, maybe on the south side of the river where we had that cosmic cold brew, then he's well on his way to solving some pretty nice problems to have. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, and if you know Marketplace, you know we love our numbers. It's kind of our signature thing. So let's dig into some important ones with our producers Sarah Menendez and Tony Wagner as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Start us off, Sarah.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
77.9 million.
That's the number of Instagram followers reality star turned model Kendall Jenner has.
This week, Jenner appeared in a controversial Pepsi commercial in which she halts her photo shoot to join a group of young people at a protest.
When the crowd is met with the line of police officers, Jenner steps up and confronts one of them with a can of Pepsi.
Critics say the commercial co-opted images from Black Lives Matter protests.
Pepsi defended the ad, saying that it intended to push a message of global unity.
But they still yanked it off the internet the next day.
250,000.
That's the daily number of cars that would normally drive over the section of highway that collapsed in Atlanta last week.
No one was hurt, but many stores in the area say that business has sharply dropped.
Atlanta is already known for being kind of a traffic nightmare, and the interstate outage is just making things worse.
relief is ways off. State officials say they're shooting to get the overpass fixed by the summer.
750,000 yen.
That's how much it costs for a suite on Japan's new luxury train, Shikishima.
That's nearly $6,800 per person for 2 days and one night of travel.
The luxury brand Belmon is launching new services in Peru in May, right on the heels of another new train that debuted in Ireland last summer.
Seems like high-end train travel is choo-choo, chugging towards a comeback.
Now we have a few more stories from Corvallis and its startup culture. We told you a little bit about Oregon State's Advantage Accelerator Program, where students, faculty, and community members learn to turn their ideas into businesses. We met with a grad student who's in the second stage of the three-step program. Her name is Ashley Ellenson, and she's designing an app called SurfOR, but that's not why she ended up in Corvallis.
I came to Corvallis because I was attracted to their coastal engineering program. There's not a lot of coastal engineering programs in the country, and this was one of a handful in a state that I wanted to live in. My project last year was looking specifically at really large wave events to determine what's the biggest type of wave that a wave energy converter would see to mitigate vulnerability. And I was interested in doing this because I'm a surfer. I wanted to basically just create a surf forecasting app for my friends. There's a need here to actually assess what the conditions are that's more accurate. The national wave forecasting, like the big wave forecasting companies, don't do a great job here at the Oregon coast. And I could see that as a surfer. And I was like, well, I have a solution and I've been working on it as research. I came to the first program of the Accelerate program, which is called Iterate. And so that's to see if you have a good match with the problem and what you think your solution would be. And since I kind of came in knowing what the problem is and knowing the solution from both angles, it was a pretty quick to make that match. Yeah. And so now I'm basically trying to bring my research to the market, which is really exciting. A lot of people are just starting to surf, don't understand how the wind will interact with the waves, will interact with the different swell directions, will interact with the beach. So if you're a new surfer, the idea behind my product is that it could be simple enough that you could understand the conditions and know when you want to go out just by looking at it at a glance. Or if you're more advanced or want to learn to become more advanced, you can kind of peel back the layers and see, oh, what's underneath of it? What are these different ingredients that would make for a really good surf session? Because here in Oregon, the conditions are really hit and miss. It's been a really cool experience kind of unlearning my engineering brain. So I'm such a systems-based and objectives-oriented person. So understanding that, you know, doing these interviews and having people go off on tangents, and I'm like, wait, you're not sticking to the script. And kind of dealing with that uncertainty and being okay with the different answers that I would get from people and pulling all of that information in and then filtering it into something that would become useful for my product. So the accelerator really taught me how to do, say, customer discovery, or how much value are you adding within each step of the way? Where do I sit in that? Is it worth it for me to be here? Am I actually adding enough value that I can reap the benefit of it? I want to try this. I want to do it. It's a really good time to do it. And I'm a grad student. I'm used to being really poor. Right. So like making money is not the top priority for me, but trying to create something and not being beholden to anybody else except for myself and my customers is exactly what I want to do. It's freedom, essentially.
Okay. So that's one business model. Another that the people at the Advantage Accelerator love to talk about is Benny Ogeri's. He started Benny's Donuts, a donut shop in town, and that's where we met up with him. It's done so well that he's opening a new restaurant next door, but the story of how he got started involves a college campus, late nights, and it's pretty amazing, so we're going to let him tell it.
I was a senior with a Bachelor of Science in Geology from local Oregon State, and I realized my senior year I didn't want to do geology, so I was added a double degree in Business Innovation Management. I think I had like $3,000 of student loan left. I took $2,000 of that and totally invested it in my startup. That got me a fryer, a sublease of a kitchen. I had enough ingredients for 2,000 donuts for the first week of soft launch. So we set up the website so you could order donuts to your door in 3 clicks. First night, Tuesday night, I had enough for 2,000 donuts for the week, remember? Within an hour of the first night, we had sold all 2,000 donuts, had to shut the website down because it was so much traffic. We're like, we got to upgrade the servers. Like, we thought it was horrible, though. Like, it seemed to me at the time, I was like, the business is imploding. This is horrible. My rule of thumb is everything takes 3 days. If something starts, it takes 3 days to peak, right? And if something's bad, it takes 3 days to get to its worst. So by Thursday, so Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Wednesday was like another hour. I was like, oh, it's closing it after an hour. So Thursday, we went through 2,400 donuts in 9 minutes because the instantaneous website, you can just order like and you refresh and it's like 55 orders. You know, you're soft launching, so you're taking a risk. Like, this is the jumping. And I jumped over a canyon and landed on, like, a field of donuts. It kind of validated this, like, whole business model that I spent 6 months making. I went from $2,000 investment to by April, we had 6 figures in sales. And then it was like, okay, what is our goal? Where are we going with this? It was just the fastest growth imaginable. And so we took all that money, a Business Oregon loan of 20 grand, and me and my new partner at this time, Niall, we did the entire build out of this restaurant ourselves. So we were able to really cut costs. The tables, the bookshelves, the bar, everything you see is it's local wood because we're poor and resourceful, and it just came out really good. And it creates this like industrial feel where we kind of focused on how can we get somebody walking by and make them backpedal and turn in. I call it like donutting, where you're like in a new city, you're past a donut shop, you backpedal a little bit because you got to try those donuts. And so essentially it became this like big city vibes in small town Corvallis. September, we opened the storefront. We grew by 602% in the first month of opening. And we've had about 4 or 5% growth consistently each month since opening. I didn't heed my own advice when I opened the storefront. I didn't plan for the worst, and then the worst happened. Like, line out the door for like a month, which is great. Like, I love lines. Don't get me wrong, I love lines. But no matter how good you can make it look to your customers, it feels like on the back end. I always say, like, the employee can look over the shoulder and there's the assistant manager or the shift lead. The assistant manager can look over the shoulder and they see the general manager. The general manager looks over her shoulder when there's a problem and they see you. And when you look over your shoulder to solve a problem, there is nobody.
It has been a very busy news week, so we're going to digest it a little with an emphasis on the U.S. economy in our segment Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance, long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it, and ask our guests to analyze topics in the news. Here to join me this week, Jim Tankersley, policy and politics editor for Vox, and Marketplace Washington correspondent Nancy Marshall Genzer. They're both joining me from D.C. Jim, why don't you start us off? What are you long?
I'm long something that is not big in the news right now, but helps us understand the news a lot, which is full employment. Unemployment is very low. Job creation remains high. Wages are going up. This is the quiet secret to Donald Trump's popularity, such as it is. It's not of his doing. The Barack Obama economy finally picked up steam at the end of his presidency. It is delivering wage gains for American workers. And it's a thing that we see even as Trump dips in the polls, Americans still like his handling of the economy. And I think this is a big reason why.
Okay, I want to stop you for a second and have you explain what the heck full employment means.
It's the level of the economy where you have just the right amount, in the eyes of economists, of people looking for jobs and people not looking for jobs. It's the just right area. And what it ends up doing is it creates a lot of competition for workers, which means wages go up.
Does that mean that we are going to see inflation pick up? Because, you know, if you're Janet Yellen or somebody else on the Fed Open Markets Committee, are you sitting there going, well, if wages are rising, does that mean that Americans are paying more for stuff?
Yeah, it does. We almost certainly will see wage inflation start to bleed into real inflation to a level which the Fed is not comfortable with. That's why they've started raising interest rates faster now. But this is the type of thing that in the late 90s was very, very good for workers. And we had a little bit of inflation that was tolerated by the Fed. It did end up, of course, ending badly with a bubble. But for a while, we had a lot of wage gains. So it's both inflationary, but also inflationary in the kind of way that helps workers.
So do you guys think, if we look at the president's poll numbers right now, approval numbers, does this help him?
Sure. I mean, any kind of good economic news is going to help whoever is in the Oval Office, even if it can't really be attributed to his policies and can more be attributed to his predecessor's policies. Sure, any good news for Donald Trump, he'll take it.
Then I want to pivot to Nancy's long, which gets into a question of Trump policy. Nancy, tell me what you're long.
Well, I am long on the Trump administration approving a Boeing sale of jets to an Iranian airline. Mm. This is a sale. Boeing says it's reached a deal for selling 30 planes with an option for 30 more to an airline in Iran. Now, they got preliminary approval for this deal under the Obama administration, but they need final approval now under the Trump administration. Now, the reason this is happening is because the U.S. and some other Western powers agreed to lift sanctions on Iran, and Iran agreed it would moderate its nuclear program. And so this is the fruit of that. Now, remember, during the campaign, President Trump said he would rip up that deal.
Yeah, bad deal, terrible deal.
But Boeing says, look, this deal would create 18,000 jobs. So I think that'll put some pressure on President Trump to approve it.
I mean, this is one of those things where this is, I guess, a flip side of the globalization we talk about. Yes, okay, jobs being shipped overseas. These are American-built planes that do go overseas.
Absolutely. And keep in mind, Airbus, which is the European aircraft maker, they have are just about to deliver their first planes to Iran. So they're ahead of us. And this is the first deal that an American company is asking the Trump administration to approve with Iran. But other U.S. companies have stayed away from Iran, and the European companies are more than happy to fill in that vacuum. You've got European car makers and gas giants stepping into Iran and making deals right and left. So, yeah, there's a lot of opportunity there.
Nancy, I want to stay with you and get to your short.
I'm going short on the Senate getting rid of the filibuster on legislation. Now, let me explain what I mean.
Yeah.
So right now, if you're a senator and you don't like a bill, you can still filibuster it. Sure, you can't filibuster a Supreme Court nomination anymore, but if you don't like a bill, you can still filibuster it. In the Senate, they still need 60 votes to stop debate on a bill. So if you don't have 60 votes, you're not going to vote. The idea is you have to cut deals with the other side because otherwise they're going to filibuster your legislation. And I don't think that filibuster is going to go away.
Jim, how do you see that? What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. And I think more than that, I think it's in everyone's interest for it not to go away. Republicans probably don't want to have a lot of up and down votes on legislative priorities this year that could be politically tenuous but demanded by the Republican base, just like Democrats don't want the danger of things like repealing the Affordable Care Act coming up for a straight up and down vote outside of special procedures that you could possibly do in the Senate. Essentially, it's a buffer from everybody's worst instincts, and everybody wants to keep that.
What's interesting is this filibuster, you know, senators being able to filibuster legislation, that has had a little bit of a moderating effect in the House. House Speaker Paul Ryan has told members of the House caucus, look, you know, don't make this health care overhaul bill too extreme because that won't pass in the Senate. That might get filibustered in the Senate. So there's even a little bit of a moderating influence of the filibuster in the House.
I mean, maybe I'm too jaded having covered Congress, but I think you're right, Nancy. There is a moderating effect that comes from having longstanding procedure.
What's that old saying? The Senate is the cooling saucer. The House is a hot cup of tea. And the senators like to call themselves the grown-ups. And the tea cools off in the Senate saucer. And then it's palatable to everybody. So they like to think of themselves as the grown-ups. Although I must say, some of the more prominent senators who were saying, oh, this is terrible. We're getting rid of the filibuster on Supreme Court nominees. Well, they went ahead and voted to get rid of the filibuster on Supreme Court nominees.
I would say this, though. Senators are also known for having longer memories than House members, partly because they serve longer terms. And so Republican senators remember what it was like not that long ago to be in the minority. And they know that if there was a swing in the midterms and then in 2020, and suddenly you had Democrats back in control of everything, if the filibuster was gone, you would suddenly have the Democrats' ability to enact single-payer health care or raise taxes on rich people by a lot, or a bunch of things that Republicans would not want to do. And that's something I think that's factoring into the Senate calculation also, is that memory of what it's like to be on the other end of the filibustering stick.
And remember, Mitch McConnell, the Senate majority leader, said he was not going to get rid of the legislative filibuster. He said that he was asked earlier this month in a press conference, would he get rid of the filibuster on legislation? He said no.
All right. So, Jim, we are setting up really your short that I think knits very well into Nancy's.
So I'm short strategy in Washington. there's just nobody around
after
town.
After all that praise of senatorial strategy.
No, no one around town seems to be acting very strategically in even a medium term interest. We've seen this obviously from the House Republicans and the White House. They didn't have a strategy to pass a health care bill, and they haven't because of that. They don't appear to have a better strategy yet for tax reform. The White House is saying it wants to lead more, but it's still not offering any principles for what it wants done. And even the Democrats in the Senate, I think, have just deployed a bad strategy with the judicial filibuster. They filibustered a Supreme Court nominee, forced it to be blown up in the nuclear option, and have nothing to show for it. They didn't really mount an affirmative case against Neil Gorsuch, and they didn't rally the public against him. And so you end up blowing up a filibuster at a time when the public doesn't really care that much about it. And what that does is it leaves them vulnerable now to a straight majority vote, for example, to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg if she were to step down. This could be a disastrous longer-term strategic decision by a party that seems more intent on pleasing its base right now.
And guess what? Guess what's happening April 28th? The continuing resolution that's funding the government right now expires. Can you say shutdown?
Please don't. Please don't say government shutdown.
Shutdown. And nobody seems to be thinking about this. The House and Senate are in Easter recess for 2 weeks. They come back and they have 4 days to prevent a government shutdown. What do you think, Jim? Is there going to be a shutdown? I am putting you on the spot.
It's hard to see how there won't be. But on the other hand, we have averted such things in the past. But this is where I'm nervous, because we do not see anyone in Washington right now who appears capable of ramming through the sort of, again, strategic maneuver you need to keep the government open, for example.
Jim Tankersley from Vox, Nancy Marshall Genzer from Marketplace. Thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Earlier in the show, you got to meet Cassie, that robot in Oregon who can walk and do it pretty naturally. On top of that, Mercedes-Benz and one of its big suppliers, Robert Bosch, just announced a partnership to develop self-driving taxis within 4 years. That's a lot of change, and fast. The other side of this robots doing stuff equation, of course, is what people will do, especially people whose jobs might change or be replaced. My colleague David Brancaccio is looking at exactly this and is here to talk about it. David, good to see you.
Good to be here.
It's nice to be in studio with you.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about this project that you launch next week?
So you and I have both done a lot of coverage about globalization, jobs going overseas. The president of the United States certainly is focused on this issue. We got to bring jobs back into this country, he says often, and I have no quibble with that notion. But what we've noticed is globalization may be not just yesterday's story, it may be the story of the last 30 years. Mm. A large threat to American jobs, as well as an opportunity, may not necessarily be foreign workers who work more cheaply. It may be technology here at home. It is the competition from within. Look, economists have told you, Lizzie, and they tell me over and over that innovation, technology, of course it destroys lots of jobs. But in the end, it creates more, better, cooler jobs. So stop worrying about all the creative destruction and all that stuff. Well, this time may be different. There's some interesting new data on this. There's a lot of interesting new thinking about this. Technology is moving so quickly that machines can do stuff that you never thought they could, replacing jobs that you thought only humans could do. I mean, look at the – was it Cassie?
Cassie. Yeah, the potential for delivering packages. And you're right. One of the things that her creators sort of said was like, well, yeah, we know that this might take away, say, the job for someone who delivers packages, but there'll be other jobs for them. And I guess that's kind of where this series comes in. You are looking at the, well – are there? And how do you get there?
So one of the first things I'm doing is I'm trying to take a positive spin here. I'm going on this road trip next week, 1,200 miles from Pennsylvania through to Wisconsin, looking for which are the jobs that are naturally resistant to these incursions by technology. There's some interesting data on this. They've tried to quantify this a little bit, and turns out in the healthcare field, a lot of those jobs are resistant to technology. Things like occupational therapy. You have to have deep wells of empathy in dealing with a patient who's just had a medical problem or some terrible injury, trying to get them back on task. Teacher, a lot of these school teacher jobs, pretty protected. They'll yeah. use more and more technology in the classroom, but what's going to replace seeing if Johnny is distracted? What's going to replace noticing, oh, I wonder if that student has got a problem at home? That kind of stuff. So we get to meet wonderful people who have these jobs that are more likely to thrive than not, given all this technology that's pouring in.
One of the watchwords that comes up over and over again in these scenarios is the idea of retraining, that you can take someone who had a certain kind of career and just pivot them to a new one. How much truth is there in that idea?
A lot of people in the technology field do worry about what it is their technology is doing to disrupt other people's lives and other people's jobs. So they often bring up this notion of, let's retrain people to better, cooler jobs that pay more. I mean, that kind of innovation leading to those better jobs is what has driven wealth in our society. So let's do more of it. But there's good retraining and there's bad retraining. I was talking to a Marketplace listener, actually, Dana Heath. He's originally from Maine. He used to be a machinist making metal molds used to form the soles of shoes. And he saw the writing on the wall about new technology. So some years ago, he tried to get retrained.
Went to night school for 7 years because I thought I was going to get out of the trade and get into something more lucrative. But by the time that 7 years was up, I was far behind in the computers. And I had a bill of about $5,000 for the college. So I really couldn't use what I had learned because I didn't learn it quick enough.
Retrained to do something that turned out to be obsolete when he was ready to take advantage of the new training. Now, he later became a volunteer ministering to the spiritual needs of prisoners.
Wow.
So he would say his story had a good outcome in the end. But I think there's a clear lesson here about retraining. You can't rack up all this debt retraining yourself, and then it turns out there's no job waiting for you. So one of the keys to this is to get the employers involved so that you know in real time what they're hiring for. So I was in Lenawee County in southeast Michigan on this robots road trip, and they're doing just that. There's this big auto parts supplier to the big car companies. They know more and more robots are piling in. They know the jobs of the future in that plant are not assembly line jobs, but people who can tend to the robots, fix them, put them in, even design them. So they're doing that kind of retraining. And what's interesting, they're doing that kind of retraining for people who already work at the company. So that you don't have to bring someone in from the outside, but someone who might get fired could stay and get a better job if that system works out.
Can you scale that? Can we make retraining better in a broader sense?
One of the cool parts of this Robot Proof Job series, and we'll hear this in a couple weeks on the air, is I asked around for big, new, interesting ideas,
yeah,
given all this technology pouring into the workplace. And here's one. It sort of hurts your head. Apparently, the Pentagon, the people who brought you the internet, DARPA, did an interesting experiment. They came up
with— A lot of scary robots.
They came up with a screen-based computer system that was shown to radically decrease the amount of time it took you to get a technical skill. It was like one-on-one tutoring on steroids. They've had a lot of luck with that. So I thought, well, maybe they could scale something like that. And the person telling me this story had this profound insight. He said, what do you think the R&D budget of the U.S. Labor Department is? Labor Department, not the Pentagon, not the Energy Department. I go, I don't know. Clearly, it's small. They don't do much R&D. What if the Labor Department
had big grants to innovative companies to come up with ways to be sure that people are not left behind in the workplace. Thought that was a very interesting idea.
David Brancaccio, host of the Marketplace Morning Report, which is bringing us robot-proof jobs all this coming week. Thank you, David.
Yeah, you bet.
If you use the internet at all, and come on, you do, you're going to want to listen to this next story because of some big changes governing how your browsing information can be used. This past week, President Trump signed a bill that would get rid of some internet privacy rules created at the tail end of the Obama administration. The issue here is whether your data can be sold to companies without your permission. It's one of a few big changes in tech policy that will affect consumers, and more are likely to come soon. Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent. Molly, can you explain what all of this means?
So what it means in a nutshell is that some rules were going to go into effect that would have governed the way that internet service providers, so think Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, that would have governed how they treat your personal data. Specifically, it would have required them to get your permission if they wanted to sell some of that data, like your browsing history, where you go online, because, you know, Comcast knows all of that. These rules had not gone into effect yet, but these rules would have stopped them and said, no, you have to ask consumers for permission first. But the new administration and the new Republican Congress basically blocked them.
As a consumer, if you're thinking about this and thinking, wait a minute, so, you know, my internet provider can sell my data, like, what? How should you think about what you do online in light of this?
The reaction to this was very interesting because I think for a lot of consumers, it was the first time they realized the depth of the information that your service providers can collect, the possibility that that data might be sold, and got them thinking, oh my gosh. This is really personal information, right? Like, if you just take a second and you think about the last five websites that you went to, and then you think, do I want somebody looking at that or advertising to me based on what those last five websites were? You know, you realize it's sensitive information.
I mean, yes or no, but it's something that certainly feels personal, I think, to a lot of people. And you're right. They did not know it was potentially for sale.
Exactly. And so it opens up that whole consumer conversation all over again about privacy. How do you protect yourself when you're online? And so I think, you know, step one for every consumer is be aware of how much could potentially be shared. Now, the immediate consumer backlash, though, did cause some of these service providers, Comcast and Verizon, came out immediately after the signing of this bill and said, whoa, 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 we're not going to do this. So step two is keep up that pressure on these companies.
Well, one of the arguments that these companies made is that they were being treated differently compared to, say, a Google or a Facebook. Does that argument hold water? And as we think about, say, the FCC and policy going forward, you know, how should we think about what functions these companies serve?
There are basically two federal agencies that can deal with consumer privacy, the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, and the FCC. And the reason that the FCC can regulate ISPs, internet service providers, is because of rules that classified the internet closer to something like a public utility. Those rules themselves are controversial and have a lot to do with net neutrality, but they also allow for, in some cases, these companies to be treated differently. That is true. Facebook is not going to be treated the same way as Comcast in this scenario. That was a true argument that they essentially said, you're a different type of provider, so you have different rules. And so the business argument was, hey, that's not fair. The consumer and privacy argument was, it may not be completely fair, but you have a lot more insight into what consumers do online. I mean, they potentially have access to an unbelievable amount of data, but the ISPs rightfully said, look, we should be able to engage in the exact same kind of business practices that Google and Facebook are engaged in with respect to advertising. And the FCC's rules stop us from doing that and basically constitute unfair competition.
I want to zoom out a little bit because there are other changes that are happening at the FCC. I know that you have looked at this a lot. And You mentioned net neutrality. So can you tell us kind of what the big things that are out there on the FCC agenda in this new administration are and how they might change?
Yeah, net neutrality is almost certainly next up on the docket when it comes to big moves by the legislature and the administration that could have a big impact on consumers. And I think one of the other things that consumers are finding out right now is that the FCC has a lot more power than they expected. And so these changes, although they sound really nerdy, are actually really significant. So as I mentioned, the reason that the FCC controls that conversation is because they, in order to create net neutrality rules, which prevent providers from discriminating against any kind of traffic on their network. It says, look, you have to deliver every website, every streaming video service equally without preference or discrimination. That all happened because the FCC changed the way the internet is regulated and reclassified it as a utility. So the new FCC under Chairman Ajit Pai could proceed in a couple of ways. They could say, we're going to try to undo that reclassification, but that's tricky. They could use sort of lack of enforcement to change the way net neutrality works. Or it could get a lot more extreme than that. We don't really know, but it is very likely that that is the next big battle ahead.
As always, we're going to have you back to explain what it means. Molly Wood, host and senior tech correspondent, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Lizzie.
We're going to end the show with a story about climate change and responding to it. Rising sea levels could wreak havoc on the economies of low-lying countries, but one nation stands to benefit, the Netherlands, which has spent centuries fighting the ocean. And as climate change begins to take its toll, the Dutch are selling their expertise around the world. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
With its four giant sails flailing in the wind, a traditional Dutch windmill is at work. Inside the mill, the great clunking wooden wheels and gears are doing the job they've done for centuries, pumping and draining. Now a tourist attraction near Amsterdam, this mill is one of many reminders of this country's unceasing struggle against water.
Already for 1,000 years, the Dutch are fighting, battling the sea, building dikes, draining the land with the windmills. We're standing here a couple of meters below sea level, and we have our feet dry. So let's say welcome to the Netherlands.
Pete Dirk of the Dutch consulting firm Arcadis. He's worked on many projects around the Netherlands, pumping, draining, building sea barriers and storing water in a country that's largely below sea level. Now, increasingly, he's working abroad.
There's so many cities around the world in deltas or in coastal zones very close to the water that are in jeopardy. Millions of people in these big cities need to be protected against the impacts of floods and climate change, and the Dutch know how to do that.
The Dutch know-how extends well beyond pumping and draining. I've come to Rotterdam Harbour to see an experimental project that could help communities cope with rising sea levels, not by draining and reclaiming land, but by building on water.
The complete structure is actually floating.
Bart Rufen and his colleagues at DeltaSync designed this floating pavilion. Under a domed roof, 10,000 square feet of floor space, bobbing ever so gently by the quayside.
Yeah, you can see it here, that there's a few centimetres of movement.
Just ever so slightly up and down.
Yeah.
The base is made of polystyrene foam encased in concrete and anchored to the sea floor by two giant mooring piles. A great way to create extra space in a densely populated country where land is scarce but water plentiful. And it's not too pricey to build.
It costs around 10 to 15% more than a regular building.
That's not huge difference.
It's not a huge difference, and the water value is not as high as the land value. So that's what you can save.
Elsewhere in Rotterdam Harbour, Peter Vingerden is planning another waterborne innovation, a floating dairy farm.
We start with 40 cows, and after that we will have 6,000 chicken. and then we have a greenhouse. So we create the first food strip on the water inside the city.
He reckons the farm will be of huge interest to low-lying coastal cities that want to guarantee their food production in case their farmland is flooded. And he insists the cows will love it too.
There's a robot that keeps cleaning the floor continuously. So the cows are on a very soft and clean floor, and they love it.
They don't prefer it to grass, surely.
And they prefer the membrane floor because it's very soft, it's very good for their feet, and it's always clean. So they prefer the membrane floor. That's very funny.
As entrepreneurs sell Dutch water expertise across the globe, they're doing what the Netherlands has always done. The technology has vastly improved, but they're still profiting from environmental adversity, benefiting from curbing the sea. In the Netherlands, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And that's our show. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman and Eliza Mills, with help from Danielle Stevens. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Brian Allison is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.